This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Persuasion, a revolutionary way to influence and persuade. Written by Robert Cialdini. Read by John Bedford Lloyd, with opening comments read by the author.
Author's note. In 1946, W. H. Auden published a poem with a line of stern advice. Thou shalt not sit with statisticians, nor commit a social science. For a long time, even high-ranking decision-makers seemed to concur, preferring to base their choices on intuition, personal experience, and anecdote. Although a name change was required in each instance, statistics is now data analytics, and social science is now behavioral science, those days are gone. They've been replaced by an era of evidence-based decision-making in the major institutions of society, business, government, education, defense, sports. It's an era that prizes information from big data analysts and behavioral scientists. I have no direct knowledge of how the transformation occurred in the realm of statistical analysis, but I've been able to observe firsthand the rise in the status of behavioral science through my experiences as a social psychologist and the author of the book Influence. When Influence first appeared in 1984, it had little impact. Sales were so disappointing, my publisher withdrew allotted advertising and promotional funds, explaining that to do otherwise would be throwing money down a pit. Few readers were interested in what a social psychologist had to say about social influence. That ended 4 to 5 years later when sales of the book began rising, eventually to bestseller levels, where they've remained ever since. I think I know what changed to cause the upswing. The times. By then, the idea of evidence-based decision-making was gaining widespread acceptance. And the book Influence offered a type of valuable evidence from scientific, social-psychological research into successful persuasion that hadn't been available before, at least not in one place. Two additional factors have played a role in the current popularity of such social-psychological analysis, and by extension, of the book Influence. The first is the rise of behavioral economics, an approach to understanding human economic choices that has challenged, and in certain domains, swept away classical economic thinking. Although staking out its own territory, behavioral economics has incorporated aspects of social psychological thinking, for example, the frequent irrationality of human conduct, as well as some social psychological methodology, for example, randomized, controlled experiments. I have colleagues who feel robbed of the credit by behavioral economists who have claimed various discoveries as their own without acknowledging existing, highly similar social psychological findings. I don't share the resentment. Although there's some overlap, it's not extensive. Moreover, if anything, behavioral economics has raised the public stature of social psychology by adopting some core features and legitimizing them in the minds of decision makers. There was a time as recently as 10 years ago when social psychologists wouldn't be invited to international conferences on government or economic policy. Again, those days are gone. The other contributor to the current acceptance of social psychological approaches is the newfound willingness of social psychologists to present their work and its relevance to the public. It's a turnabout I'd like to think Influence helped produce. Before its publication, most of my colleagues didn't feel safe, professionally, writing for a popular audience. Indeed, if social psychology had been a business, it would have been known for having great research and development units, but no shipping department. We didn't ship, except to one another, in academic journals that no general reader was likely to read. An observation by the legal scholar James Boyle captures the main reason. You have never heard true condescension until you've heard academics pronounce the word popularizer. That has changed today. Owing in some degree to the success of the book Influence, social psychologists, as well as myriad other behavioral scientists, are communicating like never before with the broader community in widely appreciated blogs, columns, videos, and books. In this respect, behavioral science is in a kind of golden age. The book Persuasion adds to the body of behavioral science information general readers find both inherently interesting and applicable to their daily lives. It identifies what savvy communicators do before delivering a message to get it accepted. Their sharp timing is what's new here. Older voices have recognized the wisdom of undertaking prior action to secure subsequent success. In asserting the value of early planning, the great military strategist Sun Tzu declared, "Every battle is won before it's fought." Consultants are taught to gain a client's business by first attaining the status of trusted advisor. Dale Carnegie assured us, "You can make more friends in 2 months by becoming genuinely interested in other people than you can in 2 years by trying to get people interested in you." All wise counsel, but there's a drawback. Days, weeks, or months of prior activity are required. Is it possible to enhance effectiveness not only inside those lengthy time frames, but also in an instant? The last instant before a communication is sent? Not only is it possible, it is established. Communicators can elevate their success by knowing what to say or do just before an appeal. The Roman orator, Cicero, recognized the sway of certain long-standing influences on human conduct. "Oh, the times," he said. "Oh, the customs." The material in this book implicates a much more immediate and manageable source of influence. Oh, the moment.
Part 1. Persuasion, the front-loading of attention. Chapter 1. Persuasion, an introduction. As a kind of secret agent, I once infiltrated the training programs of a broad range of professions dedicated to getting us to say yes. For almost 3 years, I recorded the lessons taught to aspiring automobile salespeople, direct marketers, TV advertisers, frontline managers, charity fundraisers, public relations specialists, and corporate recruiters. My intent was to find out which practices worked time after time. So I answered the organization's ads for trainees, or otherwise arranged to be present in their classrooms, notebook in hand, ready to absorb the wisdom born of long-standing experience in the business of persuasion. In these programs, advanced trainees were often allowed to accompany and observe an old pro who was conducting business. I always jumped at those opportunities because I wanted to see if I could register not just what practitioners in general did to succeed, but also what the best of them did. One such practice quickly surfaced that shook my assumptions. I'd expected that the aces of their professions would spend more time than the inferior performers developing the specifics of their requests for change, the clarity, logic, and desirable features of them. That's not what I found. Persuasion. The highest achievers spent more time crafting what they did and said before making a request. They set about their mission as skilled gardeners who know that even the finest seeds will not take root in stony soil or bear fullest fruit in poorly prepared ground. They spent much of their time toiling in the fields of influence, thinking about and engaging in cultivation. in ensuring that the situations they were facing had been pre-treated and readied for growth. Of course, the best performers also considered and cared about what, specifically, they would be offering in those situations. But much more than their less effective colleagues, they didn't rely on the legitimate merits of an offer to get it accepted. They recognized that the psychological frame in which an appeal is first placed can carry equal or even greater weight. Besides, they were frequently in no position to tinker with the merits of what they had to offer. Someone else in the organization had created the product, program, or plan they were recommending, often in fixed form. Their responsibility was to present it most productively. To accomplish that, they did something that gave them a singular kind of persuasive traction. Before introducing their message, they arranged to make their audience sympathetic to it. There's a critical insight in all this for those of us who want to learn to be more influential. The best persuaders become the best through persuasion, the process of arranging for recipients to be receptive to a message before they encounter it. To persuade optimally, then, it's necessary to persuade optimally. But how? In part, the answer involves an essential but poorly appreciated tenet of all communication. What we present first changes the way people experience what we present to them next. Consider how a small procedural difference has improved the bottom line of the consulting business of a Toronto-based colleague of mine. For years, when bidding on a big project, it wasn't unusual to get price resistance from the client, who might propose a 10% or 15% reduction. That was frustrating, he says, because he never felt comfortable padding the budget to cover this kind of potential pushback on costs. If he did agree to the cut, his profit margin became so thin it barely paid to take the business. If he didn't acquiesce, he either lost the job or produced partners who were initially disgruntled because he wasn't willing to work with them on price. Then, during one proposal meeting, he accidentally hit upon a maneuver that rid him of the problem forever. It wasn't a step-by-step attempt to specify or justify each of the expenses involved in his services. He'd long since given up on that approach, which only brought scrutiny to the bill. Instead, after his standard presentation and just before declaring his $75,000 fee, he joked, "As you can tell, I'm not going to be able to charge you $1 million for this." The client looked up from the written proposal he'd been studying and said, "Well, I can agree to that." The meeting proceeded without a single subsequent reference to compensation and ended with a signed contract. My colleague claims that this tactic of mentioning an admittedly unrealistic price tag for a job doesn't always win the business. Too many other factors are involved for that. But it almost always eliminates challenges to the charges. Although he stumbled onto it, my friend is not alone in experiencing the remarkable effects of merely launching a large number into the air, and, consequently, into the minds of others. Researchers have found that the amount of money people said they'd be willing to spend on dinner went up when the restaurant was named Studio 97 as opposed to Studio 17, that the price individuals would pay for a box of Belgian chocolates grew after they'd been asked to write down a pair of high versus low digits from their social security numbers, that participants in a study of work performance predicted their effort and output would be better when the study happened to be labeled Experiment 27 versus Experiment 9, and that observers' estimates of an athlete's performance increased if he wore a high versus low number on his jersey. What's more, the potent impact of what goes first isn't limited to big initial numbers. Other researchers have shown that just after drawing a set of long lines on a sheet of paper, college students estimated the length of the Mississippi River as much greater than those who had just drawn a set of short lines. In fact, the impact of what goes first isn't limited to numerics at all. Customers in a wine shop were more likely to purchase a German vintage if, before their choice, they'd heard a German song playing on the shop sound system. Similarly, they were more likely to purchase a French vintage if they'd heard a French song playing. So it's not one particular experience that guides what's done later. It can be exposure to a number, the length of a line, or a piece of music. And, as we will see in later chapters, it can be a brief burst of attention to any of a variety of selected psychological concepts. But, because this book is mainly about the things that enhance persuasion, those chapters give special treatment to the concepts that most elevate the likelihood of assent. It's important here to take note of my choice of the word likelihood, which reflects an inescapable reality of operating in the realm of human behavior. Claims of certainties in that province are laughable. No persuasive practice is going to work for sure whenever it is applied. Yet there are approaches that can consistently heighten the probability of agreement. And that is enough. A meaningful increase in those odds is enough to gain a decisive advantage. In the home, it's enough to give us the means to get greater compliance with our wishes, even from that most resistant of all audiences, our children. In business, it's enough to give organizations that implement these approaches the means to outpace their rivals, even rivals with equally good cases to make. It's also enough to give those who know how to employ these approaches the means to become better, even best, performers within an organization. Take, for instance, one such best performer. We can call him Jim because, what the heck, that was his name, who worked for a firm whose training program I had entered to study. The company made expensive heat-activated fire alarm systems for the home, and Jim was its top salesperson. He didn't win every sale, of course, but the likelihood that he would emerge from a sales call with a signed contract was, month after month, better than his counterparts. After an initial period of classroom instruction, I was assigned to spend the next several days accompanying various salespeople to learn how they approach the selling process. This always involved an in-home visit to a family that had scheduled an appointment for a presentation. On account of his star status, I looked closely at Jim's technique. One practice stood out as central to his success. Before beginning his sales effort, he established an aura of trust with the family. Trust is one of those qualities that leads to compliance with requests, provided that it has been planted before the request is made. Despite the mountains of scientific reports and scores of books that have been written making that point and suggesting ways to achieve trust, Jim accomplished it in a fashion I've not seen in any of them. He did it by pretending to be a bit of a screw-up. The sales sequence taught to all company representatives was fairly standard to the industry. After making small talk to build rapport, the prospects, usually a couple, were given a timed 10-minute written test of fire safety knowledge designed to reveal how little they knew about the actual dangers of a home fire. Then, at the completion of the test, representatives began the active sales pitch by demonstrating the alarm system and walking prospects through a book of materials documenting the system's superiority to all others. Everyone else brought the book into the house from the start and kept it close by, ready for use. Not Jim, though. He would wait until a couple had begun taking the knowledge test, when he'd slap his forehead and say, "Oh, I forgot some really important information in my car, and I need to get it. I don't want to interrupt the test, so would you mind if I let myself out and back into your home?" The answer was always some form of, "Sure, go ahead." Oftentimes it required giving him a door key. I watched Jim make 3 presentations. Each time his forgetfulness surfaced in the same way and at the same point. On the drive back to the office later that evening, I asked him about it. Twice, he wouldn't give me a straight answer, annoyed that I was pressing to discover his selling secret. But when I persisted, he blurted, "Think, Bob. Who do you let walk in and out of your house on their own? Only somebody you trust, right? I want to be associated with trust in those families' minds." It was a brilliant trick. Not an entirely ethical one, but brilliant nonetheless. because it embodied one of the central assertions of this book. The truly influential things we say and do first act to persuade our audience, which they accomplish by altering audience members' associations with what we do or say next. In Chapter 7, I will forward the argument that all mental activity arises as patterns of associations within a vast and intricate neural network, and that influence attempts will be successful only to the extent that the associations they trigger are favorable to change. Jim's tactic provides a good illustration. To become a top salesperson, he didn't have to modify the features of the alarm system he was selling or the logic, wording, or style of how he portrayed it. In fact, he didn't stray from the standard presentation at all. Instead, he only had to first become associated with the concept of trust, the intensely positive other associations of which would then become linked to him and his advice. Even Jim's unorthodox method of connecting himself to the concept of trust was purely associative. He didn't claim to be the sort of individual, a close friend or family member perhaps, that people let have open access to their homes. He just arranged to be treated in a way characteristic of trusted individuals of this sort. It's noteworthy that this tactic was the only real difference I registered between Jim's presentations and those of his significantly less successful co-workers. Such is the strength of mere association. All told, there are any of a number of first steps, besides establishing trust, persuaders can take that will make audiences more receptive to the case they intend to present. The steps can take multiple forms, and accordingly, they've been given multiple labels by behavioral scientists. They can be called frames, or anchors, or primes, or mindsets, or first impressions. We will encounter each of those types in the remainder of this book, where, throughout, I'm going to refer to them as openers, because they open up things for influence in two ways. In the first, they simply initiate the process. They provide the starting points, the beginnings of persuasive appeals. But it is in their second function that they clear the way to persuasion by removing existing barriers. In that role, they promote the openings of minds and, for would-be persuaders like Jim, of protectively locked doors. The Big Same. There's a joke I've heard influence practitioners tell about the difficulties of persuading prospects to move in a desired direction. It tracks an exchange between the sales representative of a marketing firm and a potential client who wants to bring out a new brand of frozen spinach. Client: Do you have experience marketing new food products? Sales rep: We have quite a lot of experience there. Client: Does that include experience in selling frozen food? Sales rep: Yes, it does. Client: How about frozen vegetables? Sales rep: We've brought several types to market over the years. Client: Spinach? Sales rep: Actually, yes, spinach too. Client: Leaning forward now, voice straining in anticipation. Whole leaf or chopped? At business conferences, the joke produces knowing, derisive laughter from the influence professionals who hear it. Of course, it was never funny the times the joke was on them, when they'd lost a contract or sale because a prospective customer, caught up in some detail of a difference, missed the big picture of what they had to offer. The contemptuous reaction to the joke's punchline always struck me as odd, because I had found persuasion practitioners guilty of the same kind of narrowness. Not in meetings with a customer or client, but in the training sessions designed to prepare them for those meetings. It wasn't long after I began operating undercover in the training classes of influence practitioners that I encountered something curious. Participants in the sessions were nearly always informed that persuasion had to be approached differently in their particular profession than in related professions. When it comes to swaying people, advertising works differently than marketing. Marketing works differently than fundraising. Fundraising works differently than public relations. Public relations works differently than lobbying. Lobbying works differently than recruitment, and so on. What's more, distinctions were stressed even within professions. Selling whole life insurance is different from selling term insurance. Selling trucks is different from selling cars. Selling by mail or online is different from selling in stores. Selling products is different from selling services. Selling to an individual is different from selling to a business. Selling wholesale is different from selling retail. It's not that the trainers were wrong in distinguishing their own bailiwick from those of their professional neighbors. But this steady referencing of their uniqueness led to a pair of lapses in judgment. First, they often detoured into distinctions of little consequence. Worse, in their emphasis on what's different among the successful persuasion professions, they didn't focus enough on an extraordinarily useful other question. What's the same? This oversight seemed a serious failing because if trainees could indeed be shown what proved convincing across the widest set of influence situations, it would help them win the day in all manner of circumstances, novel and familiar. If they could indeed be educated to understand and employ the universal principles that undergird effective persuasion, the details of the change they were hoping to generate wouldn't matter. They would do swimmingly, whether their influence attempt involved wholesale or retail, whole life or term, whole leaf or chopped. My goal during those times spent scrutinizing commercial training programs, then, was to discover what lies in parallel beneath all the truly superior professional approaches to influence. A driving question for me throughout that nearly 3-year period was, what do these approaches have in common to make them work so well? The limited footprint of the answer that emerged surprised me. I identified only 6 psychological principles that appeared to be deployed routinely in long-prospering influence businesses. I've claimed that the 6, reciprocation, liking, social proof, authority, scarcity, and consistency, represent certain psychological universals of persuasion, and I've treated each, one per chapter, in my earlier book, Influence. The Big Difference. In a portion of Persuasion, I have tried to make instructive contact with those principles again while taking an important change in direction. The earlier book was written to inform consumers how to resist influence attempts employed in an undue or unwelcome way. One factor that spurred me to write this book is that although influence has now appeared in multiple editions and sold more copies than I could have sensibly imagined, few consumer groups ever contacted me for follow-up. But my phone hasn't stopped ringing with requests from 2 other types of callers: corporate representatives inviting me to speak to their groups, and individual readers wanting to know how to become more influential in everyday interactions with coworkers, friends, neighbors, and family members. It became plain that more than just learning how to deflect or reject it, large numbers of people are ravenously interested in learning how to harness persuasion. In contrast to influence, one aim of this book is to help satisfy that hunger directly, but with a pair of dietary restrictions. The first concerns the ethics of persuasive success. Just because we can use psychological tactics to gain consent doesn't mean we are entitled to them. The tactics are available for good or ill. They can be structured to fool and thereby exploit others. But they can also be structured to inform and thereby enhance others. Chapter 13 offers a rationale, beyond the traditional one, based on the economic consequences of a damaged reputation, for why organizations should steer sharply away from unethical persuasive practices. Those practices will lend themselves to the attraction and retention of employees who find cheating acceptable and who will ultimately cheat the organization as a consequence. This book also abides by a second stipulation. although the material should be seasoned liberally with personal illustrations and accounts, the meat of the evidence has to be scientifically based. In any effort to manage the influence process successfully, a scientifically grounded approach provides a real advantage. Traditionally, persuasion has been viewed as an elusive art, the province of those few with an intuitive grasp of how to turn a phrase just so. But something radical has happened to the study of persuasion during the past half century that permits the rest of us to benefit as fully as the born masters. Researchers have been applying a rigorous scientific approach to the question of which messages lead people to concede, comply, and change. They have documented the sometimes staggering impact of making a request in a standard way versus making the identical request in a different, better informed fashion. Besides the sheer impact of the obtained effects, there is another noteworthy aspect of the results. The process of persuasion is governed by psychological laws, which means that similar procedures can produce similar results over a wide range of situations. And if persuasion is lawful, it is, unlike artistic inspiration, learnable. Whether possessed of an inherent talent for influence or not, whether insightful about the methods or not, whether a gifted artisan of the language or not, it is possible to learn scientifically established techniques that allow any of us to be more influential. Importantly different from influence is the science-based evidence of not just what best to say to persuade, but also when best to say it. From that evidence, it is possible to learn how to recognize and monitor the natural emergence of opportune moments of influence. It is also possible, but more perilous from an ethical standpoint, to learn how to create, to make, those moments. Whether operating as a moment monitor or a moment maker, the individual who knows how to time a request, recommendation, or proposal properly will do exceedingly well. It's about timing. It's about time that I finished this book that is in one sense about timing. In fact, it's several years late. I intended to write it while away from my home university during a leave of absence at a well-known business school. There, I figured, I'd have access to knowledgeable colleagues who could help me think about relevant issues, as well as an uncluttered calendar that would allow me the blocks of time I needed to write. A month or so before I was to relocate, I was negotiating with the associate dean about certain aspects of my visit that stood to make it more fruitful. An office near respected colleagues, secretarial assistance, telephone, parking, and library privileges, when I received a fateful call from him. It began wonderfully. "Bob," he said, "I have good news. I was able to get you the office you wanted. The computer in there is more powerful than the one you asked for. Don't worry about access to a secretary. The library, parking, long-distance calls, we'll take care of all that." I was grateful and told him how much I appreciated all he'd done for me. He waited a beat and replied, "Well, there's something you could do for me. We've just experienced the need for someone to teach a specialized marketing class for our MBA students. I'm in a bind, and it would really help me out if you could do it." I knew that agreeing to his request would torpedo my chances of completing the planned book during my stay because, one, I had never taught in a business school before, which meant learning a new set of teaching norms. Two, I had never taught a marketing class before, which meant developing an entire course with coordinated lectures, readings, exercises, and exams. And three, I had never taught MBAs before, which meant, for the first time in my career, I'd be allocating much of my out-of-class activities to the questions, comments, and needs of the most relentless students known to the teaching profession, first-year MBAs. I agreed anyway. I couldn't see any other appropriate option, not in the instant after expressing my sincere thanks for everything this moment maker had just provided. If he had asked the day before or the day after, I would have been able to say no. explaining that there was a book I needed to write during my stay. But the circumstances were different inside his privileged moment. Because of what he had just done for me, there was no socially acceptable alternative to saying yes. I can only be glad he didn't need a kidney. So, owing to the demands of the moment, yes, it necessarily was. And yes, at the end of my leave of absence, arranged specifically to write this book, there was no book. Family members were disappointed, as were a few editors, and I was disappointed in myself. I can see a pair of upsides to this sequence of events, though. First, instructive new research has accumulated within the domain of persuasion science, which I have incorporated into the writing. Second, the associate dean's extraordinarily effective maneuver illustrates perfectly another major assertion of this book. Persuasive practices create windows of opportunity that are far from propped open permanently. I am confident that I would have been able to muster the resources to decline the man's request if he had made it in a separate, subsequent phone call. It's because of the only temporary receptiveness that persuasive actions often produce in others that I've introduced the concept of privileged moments. The meaning of the word privileged is straightforward, referring to special elevated status. The word moment, though, is more complex, as it evokes a pair of meanings. One connotes a time-limited period, in this case, the window of opportunity following a persuasive opener, when a proposal's power is greatest. The other connotation comes from physics and refers to a unique leveraging force that can bring about unprecedented movement. These yoked dimensions, temporal on the one hand and physical on the other, have the capacity to instigate extraordinary change in yet a third psychological dimension. The remaining chapters, described briefly, show how. Part 1. Persuasion, the front-loading of attention. Chapter 2. Privileged moments. Chapter 2 explicates the concept of privileged moments, identifiable points in time when an individual is particularly receptive to a communicator's message. The chapter also presents and supports a fundamental thesis. The factor most likely to determine a person's choice in a situation is often not the one that offers the most accurate or useful counsel. Instead, it is the one that has been elevated in attention and thereby in privilege at the moment of decision. Chapter 3. The importance of attention is importance. Chapter 3 explores and documents one central reason that channeled attention leads to persuasion. The human tendency to assign undue levels of importance to an idea as soon as one's attention is turned to it. The chapter looks at the effects of channeled attention in three different arenas: effective online marketing efforts, positive consumer product reviews, and successful wartime propaganda campaigns. Chapter 4. What's focal is causal. Chapter 4 adds a second reason for why channeled attention leads to persuasion. In the same way that attentional focus leads to perceptions of importance, it also leads to perceptions of causality. If people see themselves giving special attention to some factor, they become more likely to think of it as a cause. The influence-related upshots of the what's focal is presumed causal effect are examined in domains such as lottery number choices and false confessions in police interrogations. Chapter 5. Commanders of Attention 1. The Attractors. If elevated attention provides persuasive leverage, are there any features of information that automatically invite such attention and therefore don't even require a communicator's special efforts? Chapter 5 examines several of these naturally occurring commanders of attention: the sexual, the threatening, and the different. Chapter 6. Commanders of Attention 2. the magnetizers. Besides the advantages of drawing attention to a particular stimulus, there is considerable benefit to holding it there. The communicator, who can fasten an audience's focus onto the favorable elements of an argument, raises the chance that the argument will go unchallenged by opposing points of view, which get locked out of the attentional environment as a consequence. Chapter 6 covers certain kinds of information that combine initial pulling power with staying power, the self-relevant, the unfinished, and the mysterious. Part 2. Processes. The Role of Association. Chapter 7. The Primacy of Associations. I link, therefore I think. Once attention has been channeled to a selected concept, what is it about the concept that leads to a shift in responding? All mental activity is composed of patterns of associations, and influence attempts, including persuasive ones, will be successful only to the extent that the associations they trigger are favorable to change. Chapter 7 shows how both language and imagery can be used to produce desirable outcomes, such as greater job performance, more positive personnel evaluations, and, in one especially noteworthy instance, the release of prisoners kidnapped by the Afghan Taliban. Chapter 8. Persuasive Geographies. All the Right Places, All the Right Traces. There is a geography of influence. Just as words and images can prompt certain associations favorable to change, so can places. Thus, it becomes possible to send ourselves in desired directions by locating to physical and psychological environments pre-fit with cues associated with our relevant goals. It's also possible for influencers to achieve their goals by shifting others to environments with supportive cues. For instance, young women do better on science, math, and leadership tasks if assigned to rooms with cues, photos, for example, of women known to have mastered the tasks. Chapter 9. The Mechanics of Persuasion, Causes, Constraints, and Correctives. A communicator persuades by focusing recipients initially on concepts that are aligned, associatively, with the information yet to be delivered. But by what mechanism? The answer involves an underappreciated characteristic of mental activity. Its elements don't just fire when ready. They fire when readied. Chapter 9 examines this mechanism's operation in such varied phenomena as how advertising imagery works, how infants can be persuaded toward helpfulness, and how opiate drug addicts can be persuaded into performing an important therapeutic activity that none would consent to otherwise. Part 3. Best Practices. The Optimization of Persuasion. Chapter 10. Main Roads to Change. Broad Boulevards as Smart Shortcuts. On which specific concept should an audience's attention be focused for the greatest persuasive effect? Attention should be channeled to one or another of the universal principles of influence treated in my earlier book, Influence. Reciprocity, liking, authority, social proof, scarcity, and consistency. There is good reason for their prevalence and success, for these are the principles that typically steer people in the right direction when they are deciding what to do. Chapter 11. Unity 1. Being Together. Chapter 11 reveals an additional, seventh, universal principle of influence. Unity. There is a certain type of unity, of identity, that best characterizes a we relationship, and that, if persuasively raised to consciousness, leads to more acceptance, cooperation, liking, help, trust, and, consequently, assent. The chapter describes the first of two main ways to build we relationships. by presenting cues of genetic commonality associated with family and place. Chapter 12, Unity 2, Acting Together. Besides the unitizing effect of being together in the same genealogy or geography, we relationships can result from acting together synchronously or collaboratively. When people act in unitary ways, they become unitized. And when such activity is arranged persuasively, it produces mutual liking and support. Chapter 12 provides illustrations in the forms of greater helping among strangers, cooperation among teammates, self-sacrifice among four-year-olds, friendship among school children, love among college students, and loyalty between consumers and brands. Chapter 13, Ethical Use, a pre-persuasive consideration. Those using a persuasive approach must decide what to present immediately before their message. But they also have to make an even earlier decision, whether on ethical grounds, to employ such an approach. Often, communicators from commercial organizations place profit above ethics in their appeals. Thus, there is reason to worry that the persuasive practices described in this book will be used unethically. However, Chapter 13 argues against unethical use, offering data from studies indicating that such tactics undermine organizational profits in three potent ways. Chapter 14, Post-Suasion, After Effects. Persuaders want to do more than create temporary changes via momentary shifts in attention. They want to make those changes durable. Accordingly, Chapter 14 provides the behavioral science evidence for two kinds of procedures that increase the likelihood that changes generated initially will take root and last well beyond persuasive moments. Chapter 2, Privileged Moments. Not many people know this about me, but I'm a palm reader. At least, I used to be. As a young man, I learned palmistry to use as an icebreaker at parties. I eventually abandoned the practice, though, because as soon as I'd do a reading, a line of expectant candidates would form, denying me access to meaningful conversation and the buffet table. Yet during those few years, I recognized something remarkable about the palm-based information I provided. It was almost always true. My partners in the process, strangers for the most part, were amazed by the accuracy of my depictions of their traits. "That's right," they'd say. "How could you possibly see that?" I learned to feign an all-knowing smile to evade the question because, frankly, I was amazed too. Not anymore. There are two general explanations for why I was correct so often. The first relies on paranormal mechanisms that can be mastered fully by only a select few. The second involves decidedly normal processes that can be commissioned by anyone. On the one hand, no pun intended, honest, it's conceivable that there is a real connection between the features of a human hand and its owner's character, history, and future. This type of explanation is often offered by purveyors of various paranormal systems. Besides the physical aspects of one's palm, the systems can be based on anything from star alignments to body auras to head bumps. Of course, these differences are crucial to those who proclaim the superiority of, let's say, bumps to auras for locating the truth. However, the content-based differences don't matter. In each case, we are assured that an expert practitioner using special information from the system can read our personality, past, and prospects. I doubt that my palm-reading feats can be interpreted in paranormal terms. Whenever submitted to close scrutiny, these systems flop. Back in my palm-deciphering period, I got unmistakable indications that something was amiss with paranormal methods for characterizing people. Curious about my palmistry successes, I put elements of the system to the test. sometimes reading someone's heartline as if it were the headline, that sort of thing. None of my alterations of tightly specified practices made any difference to my level of success. For instance, whether I followed or violated the proper procedure for uncovering the presence of a secret area of self-doubt within my subjects, they typically responded with the same guilty nod. On one particular evening, I was feeling out of place at a house party where I knew almost no one. Because interacting socially with strangers is one of my secret areas of self-doubt, I began doing palmistry as a way to fit in. I even read the homeowner's palm twice, once at the beginning of the night, and once when he returned a couple of hours and several drinks later, wanting to know more. In the middle of the first reading, I bent back his thumb and said, "You know, I can tell that you are quite a stubborn man." During the second reading, when bending back his thumb, I said, "You know, I can tell that you are quite a flexible man." After each of the opposing depictions, he thought for a second and admitted that I was absolutely right about who he really was. What was going on? How could my readings be viewed as accurate no matter what, within reason, I claimed to see? Critics of the paranormal offer a standard explanation. Palmists, or astrologers, or phrenologists, head bump readers, describe characteristics so widespread, stubbornness and flexibility, for example, that almost everyone can identify with them. This point is surely true, but it doesn't resolve the whole mystery. If it's so easy for people to spot their own tendencies for both stubbornness and flexibility, shouldn't these opposites cancel themselves out upon quick reflection? When I labeled the homeowner at that party a stubborn man, why didn't he counter me then and there with the natural self-awareness of his flexibility? Why did he see the truth solely in the trait I suggested when I suggested it? Not hocus, not pocus, but focus. The answer has to do with a common operating tendency that can alter a person's decisions dramatically. Suppose at a party I bent back your thumb slightly and, on the basis of its resistance and curvature, proclaimed you quite a stubborn individual, someone who resists being pressured in a direction you don't want to go. I will have focused you on the trait of stubbornness, sending you down a single psychological chute constructed unfairly to confirm my judgment. Here's how it would work. To test if I were right, you'd automatically begin searching your memory for times when you'd acted stubbornly, only for those times. And you'd almost certainly come upon a ready instance, as mulishness under pressure is a frequent personal failing. If you extended this biased search further, you'd hit on other similar occurrences. With a blink of self-recognition, you'd likely look up at me and admit that I was on target. Now imagine instead that I'd labeled you quite a flexible individual, someone who, after getting new information, is willing to take it into account and adjust your position. I'd have focused you oppositely this time, sending you down a different chute, one rigged to ensure that you'd find occasions in your past when you embraced change. As a result, you'd be likely to look up from that equally biased memory search and declare me absolutely right about your fundamental flexibility. There's a very human reason for why you'd be prone to fall for my trick. Its obtuse scientific name is positive test strategy. But it comes down to this. In deciding whether a possibility is correct, people typically look for hits rather than misses, for confirmations of the idea rather than for disconfirmations. It is easier to register the presence of something than its absence. The great mystery novelist Sir Arthur Conan Doyle understood this tendency in crafting the anything-but-ordinary thinking style of Sherlock Holmes. The brilliant Holmes was as unrelenting in his attention to what didn't occur as to what did. Recall that in one of Doyle's most popular mystery stories, Silver Blaze, Holmes realizes that a theft under investigation is an inside job, and could not have been committed by the stranger police had under arrest, because during the crime a guard dog didn't bark. His less intellectually disciplined counterparts, content to rely mainly on the presence rather than the absence of confirming evidence, never match his powers of deduction. Regrettably, you, I, and most everyone else fall into the sub-Holmesian category in this regard. In a song by Jimmy Buffett, a former lover has to be informed 5 separate times that the lack of something can convey the telling presence of something. If the phone doesn't ring, it's me. Target shooting. If I inquired whether you were unhappy in, let's say, the social arena, your natural tendency to hunt for confirmations rather than for disconfirmations of the possibility would lead you to find more proof of discontent than if I asked whether you were happy there. This was the outcome when members of a sample of Canadians were asked either if they were unhappy or happy with their social lives. Those asked if they were unhappy were far more likely to encounter dissatisfactions as they thought about it, and consequently were 375% more likely to declare themselves unhappy. There are multiple lessons to draw from this finding. First, if a pollster wants to know only whether you are dissatisfied with something, it could be a consumer product or an elected representative or a government policy, watch out. Be suspicious as well of the one who asks only if you are satisfied. Single-shoot questions of this sort can get you both to mistake and misstate your position. I'd recommend declining to participate in surveys that employ this biased form of questioning. Much better are those that use two-sided questions. How satisfied or dissatisfied are you with this brand? Are you happy or unhappy with the mayor's performance in office? To what extent do you agree or disagree with this country's current approach to the Middle East? These kinds of inquiries invite you to consult your feelings even-handedly. Decidedly more worrisome than the pollster whose leading questions usher you into a less than accurate personal stance, though, is the questioner who uses this same device to exploit you in that moment, that privileged moment. Cult recruiters often begin the process of seducing new prospects by asking if they are unhappy rather than happy. I used to think this phrasing was designed only to select individuals whose deep personal discontent would incline them toward the kind of radical change that cults demand. But now I'm convinced that the "Are you unhappy?" question is more than a screening device. It's also a recruiting device that stacks the deck by focusing people unduly on their dissatisfactions. The truth is that cults don't want malcontents within their ranks. They are looking for basically well-adjusted individuals whose positive can-do style can be routed to cult pursuits. As the results of the Canadian study show, after being prompted by the question's wording to review their dissatisfactions, people become more likely to describe themselves as unhappy. In the unfairly engineered instant after such an admission, the cult's moment maker is trained to strike. Well, if you're unhappy, you'd want to change that, right? Sure, cult recruitment tactics can offer provocative anecdotes, but cult members, including recruiters, are known for their willingness to engage in self-delusion. Maybe they're kidding themselves about the effectiveness of this particular practice. What's the hard proof that such a made moment leads to anything more than a temporarily and inconsequentially altered self-view? Could a persuader employ that moment to change another's willingness to do or concede or provide anything of real value? Merchandisers value consumer information enormously. Proponents of marketing research say it serves the admirable purpose of giving the sellers the data they need to satisfy likely buyers, and they are not alone in their high regard for the benefits of such data. Profitable commercial organizations recognize the advantages of having good information about the wants and needs of their customers or prospective customers. Indeed, the best of them consistently spend princely sums to uncover the particulars.